Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from 100 Years of the Best American Short Stories, edited by Laurie Moore. Shwila by Jamaica Kincaid. My mother died at the moment I was born, and so for my whole life there was nothing standing between me and eternity. At my back was always a bleak black wind. I could not have known at the beginning of my life that this would be so. I only came to know this in the middle of my life, just at the time when I was no longer young, and realized that I had less of some of the things I used to have in abundance, and more of some of the things I had scarcely had at all. And this realization of loss and gain made me look backward and forward. At my beginning was this woman whose face I had never seen, but at my end was nothing, no one. There was nothing between me and the black room of the world. I came to feel that my whole life I had been standing on a precipice, that my loss had made me vulnerable, that it had made me hard and helpless. On knowing this, I became overwhelmed with sadness and shame and pity for myself. When my mother died, leaving me a small child vulnerable to all the world, my father took me and placed me in the care of the same woman he paid to wash his clothes. It is possible that he emphasized to her the difference between the two bundles. One was his child, perhaps not the only child of his in the world, but the only child he had had with the only woman he had married so far. The other was his soiled clothes. He would have handled one more gently than the other. He would have given more careful instructions for the care of one than for the other. He would have expected better care for one than the other. But which one I do not know, because he was a vain man. His appearance was very important to him. That I was a burden to him then, I know. That his soiled clothes were a burden to him then, I know. That he did not know how to take care of me by himself, that he did not know how to clean his own clothes by himself then, I know. He had lived in a very small house with my mother. He was poor, but it was not because he was good. He had simply not done enough bad things yet to get rich. The house was on a hill, and he had walked down the hill balancing in one hand his child, in the other his clothes, and he gave them bundle and child to this woman. She was not a relative of his or of my mother's. Her name was Eunice Paul, and she had 6 children already, the last one still a baby. That was why she still had some milk to give me, but in my mouth it tasted sour, and I would not drink it. She lived in a house that was far from other houses, and from it there was a broad view of the sea and the mountains. And when I was irritable and unable to console myself, she would prop me up on a pile of old clothes and place me under a tree. And at the sight of that sea and those mountains, so unpitying, I would exhaust myself in tears. Ma Eunice was not unkind. She treated me just the way she treated her own children. But that is not to say that she was kind to her own children. In a place like this, brutality is the only real inheritance, and cruelty is sometimes the only thing freely given. I did not like her, and I missed the face I had never seen. I looked over my shoulder to see if someone was coming, as if I were expecting someone to come, and Ma Eunice would ask me what I was looking for, at first as a joke, but when, after time, I did not stop doing it, she thought that it meant I could see spirits. I could not see spirits at all. I was just looking for that face I would never see, even if I lived forever. I never grew to love this woman my father left me with, this woman who was not unkind to me, but who could not be kind because she did not know how. And perhaps I could not love her because I, too, did not know how. She fed me food forced through a sieve when I would not drink her milk and did not yet have teeth. When I grew teeth, the first thing I did was to sink them into her hand as she fed me. A small sound escaped her mouth then, more from surprise than from pain, and she knew this for what it was, my first act of ingratitude, and it put her on her guard against me for the rest of the time we knew each other. Until I was 4, I did not speak. This did not cause anyone to lose a minute of happiness. There was no one who would have worried about it in any case. I knew I could speak, but I did not want to. I saw my father every fortnight when he came to get his clean clothes. I never thought of him as coming to visit me. I thought of him as coming to pick up his clean clothes. When he came, I was brought to him, and he would ask me how I was, but it was a formality. He would never touch me or look into my eyes. What was there to see in my eyes then? Eunice washed, ironed, and folded his clothes. They were wrapped up like a gift in two pieces of clean nankeen cloth and placed on a table, the only table in the house, waiting for him to come and pick them up. His visits were quite steady, and so when one time he did not appear as he usually did, I noticed it. I said, "Where is my father?" I said it in English, not patois French or English, but plain English, and that should have been the surprise. Not that I spoke, but that I spoke English, a language I had never heard anyone speak. Ma Eunice and her children spoke the language of Dominico, which is French patois, and my father, when he spoke to me, spoke that language also. But no one noticed. They only marveled at the fact that I had finally spoken. That the first words I said were in the language of a people I would never like or love is not now a mystery to me. Almost everything in my life to which I am inextricably bound is a source of pain. I was then 4 years old and saw the world as a series of sketches, soft strokes in charcoal, and so when my father would come and take his clothes away, I saw only that he suddenly appeared on the small path that led from the main road to the door of the house in which I lived, and then, after completing his mission, disappeared as he turned onto the road where it met the path. I did not know what lay beyond the path. I did not know if after he passed from my sight he remained my father, or dissolved into something altogether different, and I would never see him again in the form of my father. I would have accepted it. I did not talk, and I would not talk. One day, without meaning to, I broke a plate, the only bone china plate that Eunice had ever owned, and the words "I am sorry" would not pass my lips. The sadness she expressed over this loss fascinated me. It was so intense, so overwhelming, so deep. She grabbed the thick pouch that was her stomach. She pulled at her hair. She pounded her bosom. Large tears rolled out of her eyes and down her cheeks, and they came in such profusion that if they had become a new source of water, as in a myth or a fairy tale, my small self would not have been surprised. I had been warned repeatedly by her not to touch this plate, for she had seen me look at it with an obsessive curiosity. I would look at it and wonder about the picture painted on its surface, a picture of a wide open field filled with grass and flowers in the most tender shades of yellow, pink, blue, and green. The sky had a sun in it that shone but did not burn bright. The clouds were thin and scattered about like a decoration, not thick and banked up, not harbingers of doom. It was nothing but a field full of grass and flowers on a sunny day, but it had an atmosphere of secret abundance, happiness, and tranquility. Underneath this picture, written in gold letters, was the word heaven. Of course it was not a picture of heaven at all. It was a picture of the English countryside idealized, but I did not know that. I did not know that such a thing as the English countryside existed. And neither did Eunice. She thought that this picture was a picture of heaven, offering as it did a promise of a life without worrying or care or want. When I broke the china plate on which this picture was painted and caused Ma Eunice to cry so, I did not immediately feel sorry. I did not feel sorry shortly after. I only felt sorry long afterward, and by then it was too late to tell her so. She had died by then. Perhaps she went to heaven, and it fulfilled what was promised on that plate. When I broke the plate, she cursed my dead mother, she cursed my father, she cursed me. The words she used were without meaning. I understood them, but they did not hurt me, for I did not love her. And she did not love me. She made me kneel down on her stone heap, which was situated in a spot that got direct sun all day long, with my hands raised high above my head and with a large stone in each hand. She meant to keep me in this position until I said the words, "I am sorry," but I would not say them. I could not say them. It was beyond my own will. Those words could not pass my lips then. I stayed like that until she exhausted herself cursing me and all whom I came from. And should this punishment, redolent as it was in every way of the relationship between captor and captive, master and slave, with its motif of the big and the small, the powerful and the powerless, the strong and the weak, and against a background of earth, sea, and sky, and Eunice standing over me, metamorphosing into a succession of things furious and not human with each syllable that passed her lips, with her dress of a thin, badly woven cotton, the bodice of a contrary color and pattern that clashed with the skirt, her hair uncombed, unwashed for many months, wrapped in a piece of old cloth that had been unwashed for longer than her hair. The dress had once been new and clean, and dirt had made it old, but dirt had made it new again by giving it shadings it did not have before, and dirt would finally cause it to disintegrate altogether. But she was not a dirty woman. She washed her feet every night. The day was clear. It was not the rainy time. Some men were on the sea casting nets for fish, but they would not catch too many because it was a clear day. And three of her children were eating bread, and they rolled up the inside of the bread into small pebble-like shapes and threw it at me as I knelt there, and they laughed at me. And the sky was without a cloud, and there was not a breeze. A fly flew back and forth across my face, sometimes landing on a corner of my mouth. An overripe breadfruit fell off its tree, and that sound was like a fist meeting the soft, fleshy part of a body. All this I can remember. Should it have made a lasting impression on me? But as I was kneeling there, I saw three land turtles crawling in and out of the small space under the house, and I fell in love with them. I wanted to have them near me. I wanted to speak only to them each day for the rest of my life. Long after my ordeal was over, resolved in a way that did not please Ma Eunice, for I did not say I was sorry, I took all three turtles and placed them in an enclosed area where they could not come and go as they pleased, and where they were completely dependent on me for food. I would bring to them the leaves of vegetables and water in seashells. I thought them beautiful, with their shells dark gray with faint yellow circles, their long necks, their unjudging eyes, the slow deliberateness of their crawl. But they would withdraw into their shells when I did not want them to, and when I called them they would not come out. To teach them a lesson, I took some mud from the river bed and covered up the small hole from which each neck would emerge, and I allowed it to dry. I covered over the place where they lived with stones, and for days afterward I forgot about them. When they came into my mind again, I went to take a look at them in the place where I had left them. They were, by then, all dead. It was my father's wish that I be sent to school. It was an unusual request. Girls did not attend school. I shall never know what made him do such a thing. I can only imagine that he desired such a thing for me without giving it too much thought, because in the end, what could an education do for someone like me? I can only say what I did not have. I can only measure it against what I did have and find misery in the difference. And yet... It was for that reason that I came to see for the first time what lay beyond the path that led away from my house. I can so well remember the feel of the cloth of my skirt and blouse, coarse because it was new, a green skirt and beige blouse, a uniform, its colors and style mimicking the colors and style of a school somewhere else, somewhere far away, and I had on a pair of brown canvas shoes and brown cotton socks which my father had got for me. I did not know from where. And to mention that I did not know where these things came from, to say that I wondered about them is really to say that this was the first time I had worn such things as shoes and socks, and they caused my feet to ache and swell and the skin to blister and break, but I was made to wear them until my feet got used to it. That morning was a morning like any other, so ordinary it was profound. It was sunny in some places and not in others, and the two, sunny, cloudy, occupied different parts of the sky quite comfortably, the green of the trees, the red burst of the flowers from the flamboyant trees, the sickly yellow fruit of the cashew, the smell of lime, the smell of almonds, the coffee on my breath, Eunice's skirt blowing in my face, and the stirring up of the smells that came from between her legs, which I shall never forget, and whenever I smell myself I am reminded of her. The river was low, so I did not hear the sound of the water rushing over stones. The breeze was soft, so the leaves did not rustle in the trees. And I had these sensations of seeing, smelling, and hearing during my journey down the path that began at Eunice's door and ended where it met the road. And when I reached the road and placed my newly shod foot on it, that was the first time I had done so. I was aware of this. It was a road of small stones and dirt tightly packed together, and each step I took was awkward. The ground shifted. My feet slipped backward. The road stretched out ahead of me, and then it vanished in a bend. We kept walking toward this bend, and then we came to the bend, and the bend gave way to more of the same road, and then another bend. We came to my school long before the end of the last bend. It was a small building, with one door and four windows. It had a wooden floor. There was a lizard crawling along a beam in the roof. There were three long desks lined up one behind the other. There was a large wooden table and a chair facing the three long desks. On the wall behind the wooden table and chair was a map. At the top of the map were the words, "The British Empire." Those were the first words I learned to read. In that room there were always boys. I did not sit in the schoolroom with other girls until I was older. I was not afraid in that new situation. I did not know how to be that then, and do not know how to be that now. I was not afraid then, because my mother had already died, and that is the only thing a child is really afraid of. When I was born, my mother was dead, and I had already lived all those years with Eunice, a woman who was not my mother and who could not love me, and I had lived without my father, never knowing when I would see him again, so I was not afraid for myself in this situation. And if it's not really true that I was not afraid then, it was not the only time that I did not admit to myself my own vulnerability. At the time, each thing, as it took place, stood out in my mind with a sharpness that I now take for granted. It did not then have a meaning. It did not have a context. I did not yet know the history of events. I did not know their antecedents. My teacher was a woman who had been trained by Methodist missionaries. She was of the African people that I could see, and she found in this a source of humiliation and self-loathing, and she wore despair like an article of clothing, like a mantle or a staff on which she leaned constantly, a birthright which she would pass on to us without effort. She did not love us. We did not love her. We did not love one another, not then, not ever. There were seven boys and myself. The boys, too, were all of the African people. My teacher and these boys looked at me and looked at me. I had thick eyebrows. My hair was coarse, thick, and wavy. My eyes were set far apart from each other, and they had the shape of almonds. My lips were wide and narrow in an unexpected way. I was of the African people, but not exclusively. My mother was a Carib woman, and when they looked at me, this is what they saw. And it was my teacher who, at the end of the day, in bidding me good evening, called me Miss Boiled Fish. She thought me pale and weak. I started to speak quite openly then, to myself frequently, to others only when it was absolutely necessary. We spoke English in school, proper English, not patois, and among ourselves we spoke French patois, a language that was not considered proper at all, a language that a person from France could not speak and could only with difficulty understand. I spoke to myself because I grew to like the sound of my own voice. It had a sweetness to me. It made my loneliness less, for I was lonely and wished to see people in whose faces I could see something of myself. Because who was I? My mother was dead, and when I saw my father I could not tell what I meant to him. I learned to read and write very quickly. My memory, my ability to retain information, to remember the tiniest detail, to recall who said what and when, was regarded as unusual. So unusual that my teacher, who was trained to think only of good and evil, and whose judgment of such things was always mistaken, said I was evil. I was possessed, and to establish that there could be no doubt of this, she pointed to the fact that my mother was a Carib woman. My world then, silent, soft, and vegetable-like in its vulnerability, subject to the powerful whims of others, diurnal, beginning with the pale opening of light on the horizon each morning, and ending with a sudden onset of dark at the beginning of each night, was both a mystery to me and the source of much pleasure. I loved the face of a gray sky, porous, grainy, wet, following me to school for mornings on end, shooting down soft arrows of water on me, the face of that same sky when it was a hard, unsheltering blue, a backdrop for a cruel sun, the harsh heat that eventually became a part of me, like my blood, the massive trees, the stems of some of them the size of small trunks that grew without restraint, as if beauty were only size, and which I could tell apart by closing my eyes and listening to the sound the leaves made when they rubbed together. And I loved that moment when the white flowers from the cedar tree started to fall to the ground with a silence that I could hear, their petals at first still fresh, a soft kiss of pink and white, then a day later crushed, wilted, and brown, a nuisance to the eye, and the river that had become a small lagoon when one day on its own it changed its course, on whose bank I would sit and watch families of birds and frogs laying their eggs, and the sky turning from black to blue and blue to black, and rain falling on the sea beyond the lagoon, but not on the mountain that was beyond the sea. It was while sitting in this place that I first began to dream about my mother. I had fallen asleep on the stones that covered the ground around me, my small body sinking into the surface as if it were a bed of feathers. I saw my mother come down a ladder. She wore a long white gown, the hem of it falling just above her heels, and that was all of her that was exposed, just her heels. She came down and down, but no more of her was ever revealed. Only her heels, only the hem of the gown. At first I longed to see more, and then I became satisfied just to see her heels coming down toward me. When I awoke, I was not the same child I had been before I fell asleep. I longed to see my father and to be in his presence constantly. On a day that began in no special way that I can remember, I was taught the principles involved in writing an ordinary letter. A letter has six parts: the address of the sender, the date, the address of the recipient, the salutation or greeting, the body of the letter, the closing of the letter. It was well known that a person in the position I was expected to occupy, the position of a woman and a poor one, would have no need whatsoever to write a letter, but the sense of satisfaction it gave everyone connected with teaching me this, writing a letter, must have been immense. I was beaten and harsh words were said to me when I made a mistake. The exercise of copying the letters of someone whose complaints or perceptions or joys were of no interest to me did not make me angry then. It only made me want to write my own letters, letters in which I would express my own feelings about my own life, as it appeared to me at 7 years old. I started to write to my father. "My dear Papa," I wrote in a lovely decorative penmanship, a penmanship born of beatings and harsh words. I would say to him that I was mistreated by Eunice in word and deed, and that I missed him and loved him very much. I wrote the same thing over and over again. It was without detail. It was without color. It was nothing but the plaintive cry of a small wounded animal. "My dear Papa, you are the only person I have left in the world. No one loves me, only you can. I am beaten with words. I am beaten with sticks. I am beaten with stones. I love you more than anything. Only you can save me." These words were not meant for my father at all, but the person for whom they were meant, I could see only her heel. Night after night I saw her heels, only her heels coming down to meet me. I wrote these letters without any intention of sending them to my father. I did not know how to do that, to send them. I folded them up in such a way that if they were torn along the folds, it would make 8 small squares. There was no mysterious significance to this. I did it to make them fit more neatly under a large stone just outside the gate to my school. Each day as I left, I would place a letter I had written to my father under it. I had, of course, written these letters in secret during the small amount of time allotted to us as recess, or during some time when I was supposed to be doing other work but had finished before I was noticed. Pretending to be deeply involved in what I was supposed to be doing, I would write my father a letter. This small cry for help did not bring me instant relief. I recognized my own misery, but that it could be alleviated, that my life could change, that my circumstances could change, did not occur to me. My letters did not remain a secret. A boy named Roman had seen me putting them in their secret storage place, and, behind my back, he removed them. He had no empathy or pity. Any instinct to protect the weak had been destroyed in him. He took my letters to our teacher. In my letters to my father, I had said, "Everyone hates me, only you love me." But I had not truly meant these letters to be sent to my father, and they were not really addressed to my father. If I had been asked then if I really felt that everyone hated me, that only my father loved me, I would not have known how to answer. But my teacher's reaction to my letters, those small scribblings, was fascinating to me, a tonic. She believed the everybody I referred to was herself, and only herself. She said that my words were calumny, a lie, libelous, that she was ashamed of me, that she was not afraid of me. My teacher said all of this to me in front of the other pupils at my school. They thought I was humiliated, and they felt joy to see me brought so low. I did not feel humiliated at all. Her teeth were crooked and yellow, and I wondered then how they got that way. Large half-moons of perspiration stained the underarms of her dress, and I wondered if when I became a woman I too would perspire so profusely, and how it would smell. Behind her shoulder on the wall was a large female spider carrying its sack of eggs, and I wanted to reach out and crush it with the bare palm of my hand, because I wondered if it was the same kind of spider or a relative of the spider that had sucked saliva from the corner of my mouth the night before as I lay sleeping, leaving three small painful bites. There was a drizzle of rain outside. I could hear the sound of it on the galvanized roof. She sent my letters to my father, apparently to show me that she had a clear conscience. She said that I had mistaken her scoldings, which were administered out of love for me, as an expression of hatred, and that this showed that I was guilty of the sin called pride. And she said that she hoped I would learn to tell the difference between the two, love and hate. And when she said this, I did look in her face to see if I could tell whether it was true that she loved me, and to see if her words, which so often seemed to be a series of harsh blow, were really an expression of love. Her face to me then did not appear loving, and perhaps I was mistaken. Perhaps I was too young to judge, too young to know. I did not immediately recognize what had happened, what I had done. However unconsciously, however without direction, I had, through my use of some words, changed my situation. I had perhaps even saved my life. To speak of my own situation, to myself or to others, is something I would always do thereafter. It is in that way that I came to be so extremely conscious of myself, so interested in my own needs, so interested in fulfilling them, aware of my grievances, aware of my pleasures. From this unfocused childish expression of pain, my life was changed, and I took note of it. My father came to fetch me wearing the uniform of a jailer. To him, this had no meaning. It was without significance. He was returning to Rousseau from the village of St. Joseph, where he had been carrying out his duties as a policeman. I was not told that he would arrive on that day. I had not expected him. I returned from school and saw him standing at the final bend in the road that led to the house in which I lived. I was surprised to see him, but I would only admit this to myself. I did not let anyone know. The reason I had missed my father so, the reason he no longer came to the house in which I lived, bringing his dirty clothes and taking away clean ones, was that he had married again. I had been told about this, but it was a mystery to me what it might mean. It was not unlike when I had been told that the world was round, and it was the first time I had heard such a thing. I thought, what could it mean? Why should it be? My father had married again. He took my hand, he said something, he spoke in English. His mouth had begun to curl around the words he spoke, and it made him appear benign, attractive, even kind. I understood what he said. He had a home for me now, a good home. I would love his wife, my new mother. He loved me as much as he loved himself, perhaps even more. Because I reminded him of someone he knew with certainty he had loved even more than he had loved himself. I would love my new home. I would love the sky above me and the earth below. The word love was spoken with such frequency that it became a clue to my 7-year-old mind, a clue that the love being spoken of did not exist. My father's eyes grew small, and then they grew big. He believed what he said. And that was a good thing, because I did not. But I would not have wanted to stop this progression, this going away from here. And though I did not believe him, I did not have any reason not to, and I was not yet cynical. I did not yet think that behind everything I heard lay another story altogether. I thanked Eunice for taking care of me. I did not mean it, I could not mean it, but I would mean it if I said it now. I did not say goodbye. All my belongings were in a muslin knapsack, and my father placed it in a bag that was strapped on the donkey he had been riding. He placed me on the donkey, and then he sat behind me, and this was how we looked as my back was turned on the small house in which I spent the first 7 years of my life. A man and his small daughter on the back of a donkey at the end of an ordinary day, a day that had no meaning if you were less than a smudge on a page covered with print. I could hear my father's breath. It was not the breath of my life. The back of my head touched his chest from time to time. I could hear the sound of his heart beating through the shirt of his uniform, a uniform that made people afraid when they saw him coming toward them. His presence in my life then was a good thing, and it was too bad that he had not thought of changing his clothes. It was too bad that I noticed he had not done so. It was too bad that such a thing would matter to me. This new experience of leaving the past behind, of going from one place to another and knowing that whatever had been would remain just as it had been, was something I immediately accepted as a gift. This simple movement, the turning of your back to leave something behind, is among the most difficult to make, but once it has been made, you cannot imagine that it was at all hard to accomplish. I had not been able to do it all by myself, but I could see that I had set in motion the events that would make it possible. If I were ever to find myself sitting in that schoolroom again, or sitting in Eunice's yard again, sleeping in her bed, eating with her children, none of it would have the same power it had once had over me, the power to make me feel helpless and ashamed of my own helplessness. I could not see the look on my father's face as we rode. I did not know what he was thinking. I did not know him well enough to guess. He set off down the road in the opposite direction from the schoolhouse. This stretch of road was new to me, and yet it had a familiarity that made me sad. Around each bend was a familiar dark green of the trees that grew with a ferociousness that no hand had yet attempted to restrain. Green unrelenting and complete. Nothing could be added to it, and nothing could be taken away from it. Each precipice along the road was steep and dangerous, and a fall down one of them would result in death or a lasting injury. And each climb up was followed by a slope down, at the bottom of which clustered along the road a choke of flowering plants, each plant with a purpose not yet known to me. And each curve that ran left would soon give way to a curve that ran right. The day then began to have the colors of an ending, the colors of a funeral, gray and mauve, and my sadness became manifest to me. I was a part of a procession of sadness which was moving away from my old life, a life I had lived then for only 7 years. I did not become overwhelmed, though. The dark of night came on with its usual suddenness. My father placed an arm around me then, as if to ward off something, a danger I could not see in the cool air, an evil spirit, a fall. His clasp was at first gentle, then it grew tighter. It had the strength of an iron band. I did not become overwhelmed. We entered the village in the dark. There were no lights anywhere, no dog barked, we did not pass anyone. We entered the house in which my father lived, and there was a light coming from a beautiful glass lamp, something I had never seen before. The light was fueled by a clear liquid that I could see through the base of the lamp, which was embossed with the heads of animals unfamiliar to me. The lamp was on a shelf, and the shelf was made of mahogany, its brackets curling in the shape of two tightly closed paws. The room was crowded, containing a chair on which two people could sit at once, two other chairs on which only one person could sit, and a small low table draped with a piece of white linen. The walls of the house and the partition that separated this first room from the other rooms of the house were covered with a kind of paper, and the paper was decorated with small pink roses. I had never seen anything like this before, except once, while looking through a book at my school. But the picture I had seen then was a drawing, illustrating a story about the domestic life of a small mammal who lived in a field with his family. In their burrow, the walls had been covered with similar paper. I had understood that story about the small mammal to be a pretense, something to amuse a child, but this was my father's very real house, a house with a bright lamp in a room, and a room that seemed to exist only for an occasional purpose. At that moment I realized that there were so many things I did not know, not including the very big thing I did not know, my mother. I did not know my father. I did not know where he was from, or whom and what he liked. I did not know the land whose surface I had just crossed on an animal's back. I did not know who I was or why I was standing there in that room of occasional purpose with the lamp. A great sea of what I did not know opened up before me, and its treacherous currents pulsed over my head repeatedly until I was sure I was dead. I had only fainted. I opened my eyes soon after that to see the face of my father's wife not too far above mine. She had the face of evil. I had no other face to compare it with. I only knew that this was a face of evil as far as I could tell. She did not like me, I could see that. She did not love me. I could see that. I could not see the rest of her right away, only her face. She was of the African people and the French people. It was nighttime, and she was in her own house, so her hair was exposed. It was smooth and yet tightly curled, and she wore it parted in the middle and plaited in two braids that were pinned up in the back. Her lips were shaped like those of people from a cold climate, thin and ungenerous. Her eyes were black, and not with beauty, but with deceit. Her nose was long and sharp, like an arrow. Her cheekbones were also sharp. She did not like me. She did not love me. I could see it in her face. My spirit rose to meet this obstacle. No love. I could live in a place like this. I knew this atmosphere all too well. Love would have defeated me. Love would always defeat me. In an atmosphere of no love, I could live well. In this atmosphere of no love, I could make a life for myself. She held a cup to my mouth, and one of her hands brushed against my face, and it felt cold. She was feeding me a tea, something to revive me, but it tasted bitter like a bad potion. My small tongue allowed no more than a drop of it to come into my mouth, but the bad and bitter taste of it warmed my young heart. I sat up. Our eyes did not meet and lock. I was too young to throw out such a challenge. I could then act only on instinct. I was led down a short hallway to her room. It was to be my own room. My father lived in a house in which there were so many rooms that I could occupy my own. This small event immediately became central to my life. I adjusted to this evidence of privacy without question. My room was lit by a small lamp, the size of my fist, and I could see my bed, small, of wood, a white sheet on its copper-filled mattress, a square flat pillow. I had a washstand on which stood a basin and an urn that had water in it. I did not see a towel. I did not then know how to wash myself properly in any case, and the lesson I eventually got came with many words of abuse. There was not a picture on the wall. The walls were not covered with paper. The bare wood, pine, was not painted. It was the plainest of plain rooms, but it had in it more luxury than I had ever imagined. It offered me something I did not even know I needed. It offered me solitude. All of my little being, physical and spiritual, could find peace here in this little place where I could sit and take stock. I sat down on the bed. My heart was breaking. I wanted to cry. I felt so alone. I felt in danger. I felt threatened. I felt as each minute passed that someone wished me dead. My father's wife came to say good night, and she turned out the lamp. She spoke to me then in French patois. In his presence she had spoken to me in English. She would do this to me through all the time we knew each other. But that first time, in the sanctuary of my room, at 7 years old, I recognized this as an attempt on her part to make an illegitimate of me, to associate me with the made-up language of people regarded as not real, the shadow people, the forever humiliated, the forever low. Then she went on to the part of the house where she and my father slept. It was far away. I could hear the sound of her footsteps fade. I could hear their voices as they spoke, the sound swirling upward to the empty space beneath the ceiling. They had a conversation. I could not make out the words. The emotion seemed neutral, neither hot nor cold. And there was some silence. There were short gasps and sighs. There was a sound of people sleeping, breath escaping through their mouths. I lay down to sleep to dream of my mother, for I knew I would do that. I knew I would make myself do that. She came down the ladder again and again, over and over, just her heels and the hem of her white dress visible. Down, down. I watched her all night in my dream. I did not see her face. I was not disappointed. I would have loved to see her face, but I didn't long for it any more. She sang a song, but it had no words. It was not a lullaby. It was not sentimental, not meant to calm me when my soul roiled at the harshness of life. It was only a song, but the sound of her voice was like treasure found in an abandoned chest, a treasure that inspires not astonishment, but contentment and eternal pleasure. All night I slept, and in my sleep saw her feet come down the ladder, step after step. And I heard her voice singing that song, sometimes humming, sometimes through an open mouth. To this day she will appear in my dreams from time to time, but never again to sing or utter a sound of any kind. Only as before, coming down a ladder, her heels visible and the white hem of her garment above them. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. Continuing our story. I came to my father's house in the blanket of voluptuous blackness that was the night. A morning naturally followed. I awoke to the same landscape that I had always known, each aspect of it beyond reproach, at once beautiful, ugly, humble, and proud, full of life, full of death, able to sustain the one, inevitably to claim the other. My father's wife showed me how to wash myself. It was not done with kindness. My human form and odor were an opportunity to heap scorn on me. I responded in a fashion by now characteristic of me. Whatever I was told to hate, I loved. I loved the smell of the thin dirt behind my ears, the smell that comes from between my legs, the smell in the pits of my arms, the smell of my unwashed feet. Whatever about me caused offense, whatever was native to me, whatever I could not help and was not a moral failing, those things about me I loved with the fervor of the devoted. Her hands, as they touched me, were cold and caused me pain. In her was a despair rooted in a desire long thwarted. She had not been able to bear my father a child. She was afraid of me. She was afraid that because of me my father would think of my mother more often than he thought of her. On that first morning she gave me some food, and it was old, moldy, as if she had saved it especially for me in order to make me sick. I did not eat what she offered after that. I learned then how to prepare my own food, and made this a trait by which others would know me. I was a girl who prepared her own food. Parts of my life then, incidents in my life then, seem, when I remember them now, as if they were taking place in a very small, dark place, a place the size of a doll's house, and the doll's house is at the bottom of a cellar, and I am way up at the top of the stairs peering down into this little house, trying to make out exactly what's happening down there. And sometimes when I look down at this scene, certain things are not in the same place they were in the last time I looked. Different things are in the shadows, different things are in the light. Who was my father? Not just who he was to me, his child, but who was he? He was a policeman, but not an ordinary policeman. He inspired more than the expected amount of fear for someone in his position. He made appointments to see people, men, at his house, the place where he lived with his family, this entity of which I was now a sort of member, and he would make these people wait for hours or he wouldn't show up at all. They waited for him, sometimes sitting on a stone that was just inside the gate of the yard, sometimes pacing back and forth from inside the yard to outside the yard, causing the gate to creak, and this always made his wife cross, and she would complain to these people, speaking rudely to them, the rudeness way out of proportion to the annoyance of the creaky gate. They waited for him without complaint, sometimes falling asleep standing up, sometimes falling asleep as they sat on the ground. They waited, and when he did not show up, they left and returned the next day, hoping to see him. Sometimes they did, sometimes they did not. He suffered no consequences for his behavior. He just treated people in this way. He did not care, or so I thought at first. But of course he did care. It was well thought out, this way he had of causing suffering. He was part of a whole way of life on the island which perpetuated pain. At the time I came to live with him, he had just mastered the mask that he wore for the remainder of his life. The skin taut, the eyes small and drawn back as though deep inside his head, so that it wasn't possible to get a clue to him from them. The lips parted in a smile. He seemed trustworthy. His clothes were always ironed, clean, spotless. He did not like people to know him very well. He tried never to eat food in the presence of strangers or in the presence of people who were afraid of him. Who was he? I ask myself this all the time to this day. Who was he? He was a tall man. His hair was red. His eyes were gray. He must have loved me then. He had told me so. I never heard him say words of love to anyone. He wanted me to continue going to school, but I did not know why. It was a great sacrifice that I should go to school, because, as his wife often pointed out, I would have been more useful at home. He gave me books to read. He gave me a life of John Wesley, and as I read it, I wondered what the life of a man so full of spiritual tumult and piety had to do with me. My father had become a Methodist and attended church every Sunday. He taught Sunday school. The more money he had, the more he went to church. And the richer he became, the more fixed the mask of his face grew, so that I no longer remember what he really looked like when I first knew him long ago, before I came to live with him. And so my mother and father then were a mystery to me, one through death, the other through the maze of living, one I had never seen, the other I saw constantly. The world I came to know was full of treachery, but I did not remain afraid. I did not become cautious. I was not indifferent to the danger my father's wife posed to me, and I was not indifferent to the danger she thought my presence posed to her. So in my father's house, which was her home, I tried to cloak myself in an atmosphere of apology. I did not, in fact, feel sorry for anything at all, and I had not done anything, either deliberately or by accident, that warranted my begging for forgiveness, but my gait was a weapon, a way of deflecting her attention from me, of persuading her to think of me as someone who was pitiable, an ignorant child. I did not like her, I did not wish her dead, I only wanted her to leave me alone. I would lie in my bed at night and turn my ear to the sounds that were inside and outside the house, identifying each noise, separating the real from the unreal, whether the screeches that crisscrossed the night, leaving the blackness to fall to the earth like so many ribbons, were the screeches of bats or of someone who had taken the shape of a bat, whether the sound of wings beating in that space so empty of light was a bird or someone who had taken the shape of a bird. The sound of the gate being opened was my father coming home long after the stillness of sleep had overtaken most of his household, his footsteps stealthy but sure, coming into the yard, up the steps, his hand opening the door to his house, closing the door behind him, turning the bar that made the door secure, walking to another part of the house. He never ate meals when he returned home late at night. The sound of the sea then at night could be heard clearly, sometimes as a soft swish, a lapping of waves against the shore of black stones, sometimes with the anger of water boiling in a cauldron resting unsteadily on a large fire. And sometimes, when the night was completely still and completely black, I could hear, outside, the long sigh of someone on the way to eternity. And this, of all things, would disturb the troubled peace of all that was real. The dogs asleep under houses, the chickens in the trees themselves moving about, not in a way that suggested an uprooting, just a moving about, as if they wished they could run away. And if I listened again, I could hear the sound of those who crawled on their bellies, of those who carried poisonous lances, and those who carried a deadly poison in their saliva. I could hear the ones who were hunting, the ones who were hunted, the pitiful cry of the small ones who were about to be devoured, followed by the temporary satisfaction of the ones doing the devouring. All this I heard night after night, and it ended only after my hands had traveled up and down all over my own body in a loving caress, finally coming to the soft, moist spot between my legs, and a gasp of pleasure had escaped my lips, which I would allow no one to hear. And that story was Shwila by Jamaica Kincaid from 100 Years of the Best American Short Stories, edited by Laurie Moore. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Sun Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. The Signing by Stephen Dixon. My wife dies. Now I'm alone. I kiss her hands and leave the hospital room. A nurse runs after me as I walk down the hall. Are you going to make arrangements now for the deceased? He says. No. Then what do you want us to do with the body? Burn it. That's not our job. Give it to science. You'll have to sign the proper legal papers. Give me them. They take a while to draw up. Why don't you wait in the guest lounge? I haven't time. And her toilet things and radio and clothes. I have to go. I ring for the elevator. You can't do that. I am. The elevator comes. Doctor! Doctor! He yells to a doctor going through some files at the nurse's station. She stands up. What is it, nurse? She says. The elevator door closes. It opens on several floors before it reaches the lobby. I head for the outside. There's a security guard sitting beside the revolving door. He looks like a regular city policeman other than for his hair, which hangs down past his shoulders, and he also has a beard. Most city policemen don't, maybe all. He gets a call on his portable two-way set as I step into one of the quarters of the revolving door. Laszlo, he says into it. I'm outside. Hey, you, he says. I turn around. He's nodding and pointing to me and waves for me to come back. I cross the avenue to get to the bus stop. He comes outside and slips the two-way into his back pocket and walks up to me as I wait for the bus. They want you back upstairs to sign some papers, he says. Too late. She's dead. I'm alone. I kissed her hands. You can have the body. I just want to be far away from here and as soon as I can. They asked me to bring you back. You can't. This is a public street. You need a city policeman to take me back, and even then I don't think he or she would be in their rights. I'm going to get one. The bus comes. Its door opens. I have the required exact fare. I step up and put my change in the coin box. "Don't take this man," the guard says to the bus driver. "They want him back at the hospital there. Something about his wife, who was or is a patient, though I don't know the actual reason they want him for." "I've done nothing," I tell the driver, and take a seat in the rear of the bus. A woman sitting in front of me says, "What's holding him up? This isn't a red light." "Listen," the driver says to the guard, "if you have no specific charge or warrant against this guy, I think I better go." "Will you please get this bus rolling again?" a passenger says. "Yes," I say, disguising my voice so they won't think it's me but some other passenger. "I've an important appointment, and your slow-pokey driving and intermittent dawdling has already made me 10 minutes late." The driver shrugs at the guard. "In or out, friend, but unless you can come up with some official authority to stop this bus, I got to finish my run." The guard steps into the bus, pays his fare, and sits beside me as the bus pulls out. "I'll have to stick with you and check in, if you don't mind," he says to me. He pushes a button in his two-way set and says, "Laszlo here." "Laszlo," a voice says, "where the hell are you?" "On a bus." "What are you doing there? You're not through yet." "I'm with the man you told me to grab at the door." "Well, he got past the door. I tried to stop him outside, but he said I needed a city patrolman for that because it was a public street." "You could have gotten him on the sidewalk in front." "This was at the bus stop across the street." "Then he's right. We don't want a suit." "That's what I thought. So I tried to convince him to come back. He wouldn't. He said he'd kiss some woman's hands and we can have the body. I don't know what that means, but want to get it all in before I get too far away from you and lose radio contact. He got on this bus. The driver was sympathetic to my argument about the bus not leaving, but said it would be illegal, his helping to restrain the man, and that he also had to complete his run. So I got on the bus and am now sitting beside the man and will get off at the next stop if that's what you want me to do. I just didn't know what was the correct way to carry out my orders in this situation, so I thought I'd stick with him till I found out from you. You did the right thing. Let me speak to him now. Laszlo holds a two-way in front of my mouth. Hello, I say. The papers to donate your wife's body to the hospital for research and possible transplants are ready now, sir. So could you return with Officer Laszlo? No. If you think it'll be too trying an emotional experience to return here, could we meet someplace else where you could sign? Do what you want with her body. There's nothing I ever want to have to do with her again. I'll never speak her name. Never go back to our apartment. Our car I'm going to let rot in the street till it's towed away. This wristwatch, she bought it for me and wore it a few times herself. I throw it out the window. Why didn't you just pass it on back here? The man behind me says. These clothes, she bought some of them, mended them all. I take off my jacket, tie, shirt, and pants and toss them out the window. Look it, Laszlo says. I'm just a hospital security guard with a pair of handcuffs I'm not going to use on you because we're in a public bus and all you've just gone through, but please calm down. This underwear I bought myself yesterday, I say to him. I needed a new pair. She never touched or saw them, so I don't mind still wearing them. The shoes go, though. She even put on these heels with a shoe repair kit she bought at the Five and Dime. I take off my shoes and drop them out the window. The bus has stopped. All the other passengers have left except Laszlo. The driver is on the street looking for what I'm sure is a patrolman or a police car. I look at my socks. I'm not sure about the socks. Leave them on, Laszlo says. They look good, and I like brown. But did she buy them? I think they were a gift from her 2 birthdays ago when she gave me a cane picnic basket with 12 pairs of different colored socks inside. Yes, this is one of them, and I take them off and throw them out the window. That's why I tried and still have to get out of this city fast as I can. You hear that? Laszlo says into the two-way radio, and the man on the other end says, I still don't understand. You see, I say into it, we spent too many years here together, my beloved and I, all our adult lives. These streets, that bridge, those buildings. I spit out the window. Perhaps even this bus. We took so many rides up and down this line. I try to uproot the seat in front of me, but it won't budge. Laszlo clasps the cuffs on my wrists. This life, I say, and I smash my head through the window. An ambulance comes and takes me back to the same hospital. I'm brought to emergency and put on a cot in the same examining room she was taken to this last time before they moved her to a semi-private room. A hospital official comes in while the doctors and nurses are tweezing the remaining glass splinters out of my head and stitching me up. "If you're still interested in donating your wife's body," he says, "then we'd like to get the matter out of the way while some of her organs can still be reused by several of the patients upstairs." I say, "No, I don't want anyone walking around with my wife's parts where I can bump into him and maybe recognize them any day of the year." But he takes my writing hand and guides it till I've signed. And that story is The Signing by Stephen Dixon from Sudden Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Sheppard and James Thomas. And now from The World's Shortest Stories, edited by Steve Moss. The Salon Visit by Elizabeth Eula. "Anyway," the woman in the chair continued, "his wife's so gullible. Bill always says he's going bowling. She always believes him." The beautician smiled. "My husband, William, loves bowling. Never used to. Goes all the time now." She paused, frowning. Then a slow, bitter smile emerged. "Let's start on your perm. You're going to look unforgettable." And that was The Salon Visit by Elizabeth Eula from The World's Shortest Stories, edited by Steve Moss. And that's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can also listen to Sunsounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sunsounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me, and bye for now.